Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside.
Gonna study
Louis Armstrong's version of Down by the Riverside, bringing us into this hour. Hello again, everyone. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. And now we continue our series, The End of War, inspired by science journalist John Horgan's book of the same name. We're asking you and a variety of guests if humanity can ever abolish war as a legitimate institution, like it abolished slavery as one. Today, we're asking what role international law might play in delegitimizing war, the UN and other organizations, and law itself. We'll also talk about some of the recent news from Iran, Afghanistan, and Syria in this light. We'll talk second to President Clinton's former UN ambassador, Nancy Soderberg. First, Weekly Standard editor William Kristol, a leading voice to launch the Iraq War 10 years ago. Mr. Kristol, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you. First, the basic question that we're asking everyone in this series. Do you think human beings can ever stop fighting wars? The question itself rarely gets asked.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's no reason to think so, and human nature hasn't fundamentally changed, and war is produced by both scarcities of goods, which despite economic growth won't fully go away, and more importantly probably by other things ranging from, you know, religious belief to nationalism to ancient hatreds to new hatreds to ambitious leaders, and none of that's likely to go away. So I think the damage of war can, one hopes, be minimized. The likelihood of it can be reduced, but it certainly won't go away.
What about slavery as an example? If that was once seen as a legitimate institution in economic terms, why couldn't war be kind of culturally ostracized as a means to resolving conflicts around the world, eventually, gradually?
Well, we certainly should minimize it. I'm very happy that chattel slavery has been abolished, more or less. Incidentally, it's not entirely gone, I'm
right.
afraid.
And of but course, nobody but, sees but, it as legitimate anymore.
No, but do people see, have people in very recent times and in allegedly civilized parts of the world seen the persecution and the destruction of other ethnic groups and other religious groups as legitimate? They have, and I don't think that, unfortunately, has changed as much as one would hope. And you know, and I think war is even more fundamental in the sense that wars can happen between nations that it, not based on, you know, a horrible view of the other people as a lesser type of human being, but just because of border conflicts and different claims to the land, where you can be a perfectly decent person and still end up in a war because, you know, there's only so much one country or another is going to control a particular part of this earth.
Philosophically, you're known as a neoconservative. Nancy Soderberg, our following guest, comes from a different political philosophy. And neoconservatism is also often seen by others as more warlike or more prone to advocate use of the U.S. military. How much would you accept or reject that description?
Well, I wouldn't entirely reject it. I would argue that the uses of the U.S. military would be to help prevent larger conflict, prevent greater war. I mean, would a preemptive strike against Iran to set back the nuclear program, that would be an act of war. Could it save lives down the road? Well, certainly in other historical circumstances, one could argue, I would certainly argue, that such preemptive use of force would have and has at times saved lives. So, yes, if being a neoconservative means being skeptical that diplomacy would always work, that sanctions will always work, that engagement always works, that being strong and ready for war might deter war, and that at times the use of force might prevent a greater calamity, I'd be willing to make that case.
Neoconservatism is also seen as believing strongly in American exceptionalism, including the unique morality of the United States in world affairs. Would you put it that way?
No. I mean, I think America has an exceptional role to play because we are the anchor of of the world system, to the degree there is a system. I think we're the anchor of the forces of freedom and of liberal democracy, and I think our being in retreat is damaging and dangerous for those around the world who would hope to have a freer and more liberal world order. I think that's been the case for decades now, and I don't think it requires us to say that Americans are better than anyone else. I always, you know, I admire the British in 1940. I think we're more admirable than anything Americans have probably done. Maybe we did some pretty admirable things in World War II, too, but, you know, standing alone against Hitler, we were on the sideline. And that would be a case, incidentally, where our being on the sideline and not participating in the war didn't shorten the war and didn't make the world less likely to have a war and didn't make it less likely that tens of millions of people would die. Our being staying out of things in the 30s made it more likely, unfortunately, that more people had to die before we were able to defeat the Nazis and so forth. So, no, but I don't think there's that kind of moral preening about the United States. But, look, people are being killed in Syria. Either the West is going to intervene or we're not. Maybe you can make a case, many people would, that we shouldn't intervene, that somehow we're limited, the Russians and Chinese don't want us to, it's dangerous, there are risks, all that is true. I would make the case that a more forward-leaning policy in China is in Syria is likely to save lives, is likely to result in a regime change that will result in a better life for the people of Syria, will actually reduce the chances of bigger war in the Middle East, will help remove a very bad regime with a reasonable chance, not a certainty, a reasonable chance of a better regime. So that's the real world we live in, you know, and you can't say, gee, some people want war and some people don't want war. People are being killed in Syria right now, and the question is what to do about it. And, you know, to do nothing is a choice just as much as it would be to arm the rebels or to try to enforce, you know, a no-fly or no-drive zone or all the other possibilities that are being debated.
I think you and Nancy Soderbergh are going to agree on this.
I think we're not that far apart, perhaps.
She's also advocating use of force in Syria. What do you think that could look like, by the way, which is a little off our end of war topic, but the, you know, so many people who are skeptical of intervening militarily in Syria say it's not like Libya, a no-fly zone, couldn't do most of it to stop the killing of civilians, and a ground war would just be so messy and horrible and long and protracted. So what do you think could be done?
Well, look, there we could arm the rebels. I think this is more like Bosnia, probably, than like Libya, where there's one side with overwhelming force and the power of government behind it, pretty much slaughtering at this point another side. And not that everything's wonderful now in Bosnia and Kosovo, but I think it was better for us to have intervened than not to have. And I think a lot of people died when we sat on the sidelines and debated it. And I think you could end up with that kind of situation where the regime falls and we end up with something else. Now, you know, Libya didn't look so easy either. I mean, afterwards, everyone decides that, well, you know, Libya was somehow easy and Syria is much harder. That could be, honestly. I think that's a very hard judgment to make. You don't have the geographic clarity in Syria that you might have we did happen to have in Libya. And things may not end up that great in Libya, ultimately. It's a problematic place. But I do think in Syria, from a national interest point of view, which also matters, Syria is a client state of Iran. If you think weakening Iran is a good thing, and I think most people would agree with that, or certainly weakening Iran's ambitions and nuclear capabilities is a good thing, weakening one of their allies is probably a good thing. So I think in Syria you have a coincidence of a humanitarian case and a U.S. And Western kind of national interest case.
Do you have much reason to believe that the rebels, if they were to take power, would be any better in terms of pro-Western policies or not being interested in aligning with Iran? Or are they just, you know, another group of Syrians that wants power in that country and then might have the same kind of foreign policy?
That's possible, and, you know, that would always be a constraint against intervening anywhere. And I think we can help shape what kinds of rebels take power and how they think when they take power by intervening with them. I think the worst case is to stand aside. That sort of increases the chances of one group of thugs replacing another. But I think on the Iran question, I think it's very unlikely, since the Iranian regime is so backed to this Syrian regime, whatever the character of the rebels who took over, they might not be, you know, wonderful Jeffersonian Democrats. I think it's unlikely they'd be very friendly to Iran. It's just in that respect, I think it would be a strategic gain.
Mm-hmm. William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard. Our guest in our End of War series, former Clinton ambassador to the UN, Nancy Soderberg, our next guest coming up in a few minutes. So back to the question of the end of war and international law or international institutions. On the institutions,
right.
The UN was founded after World War II largely with that goal in mind, to prevent the horrors of both world wars from recurring by having a global diplomatic infrastructure where nations would have the opportunity to talk to each other, where legitimacy of specific military actions would be debated, where not only the countries with the biggest militaries would have a voice. Do you think the whole idea is pie in the sky?
I think the whole idea is limited in its utility, partly because everyone is a member of the UN, which is key to its working on the one hand, but also means that Syria is there and China is there and Russia is there and Iran is there. So, you know, if you think the problem is the Syrian government killing its people or the Iranian regime trying to get nuclear weapons, it's pretty hard to depend on an organization that includes Syria and Iran and gives them a vote and it gives their allies in some respects a veto to do that much. I mean, I'm not, you know, dogmatically against the UN. They've done good in some cases. They've been an obstacle to acting in some cases. And my biggest beef with the UN and with those who put too much weight on it is it can be paralyzing. We didn't act in the Sudan. We're not acting in Syria in a way because the UN exists. I'm not an isolationist or an America firster. I think we need strong alliances, but I would be more inclined to look at NATO, to look at our various alliances in Asia, to look at alliances of liberal democracies around the world, or at least of liberal democracies and those who are not too hostile to liberal democracy, to do good, to advance you know, our principles and our interests around the world, rather than a global organization like the UN. I think where the UN does the most good, look, in health, you know, viruses cross borders regardless of the nature of regimes. So a World Health Organization that can monitor the spread of diseases and help governments act to stop that, you know, and coordinate, that's obviously a good thing. No one thinks that isn't a good thing. And indeed, such a thing, I believe the World Health Organization existed before the UN did. So there are times when you want a global universal group, but there are other times when I would argue you might want a group of like-minded nations to be able to band together to help enforce peace and prevent war.
Do you think that international law can reduce war, if not abolish it?
I think international law, which has existed for centuries, of course, has done a lot of useful things. On the other hand, you know, international law was extremely well developed in 1913 and 1914 in all kinds of ways, and it didn't stop World War I. So, no, I don't think it can abolish law. It can do a lot of good in the way in which, you know, wars are fought and the treatment of prisoners, obviously all these kinds of things where it can really ameliorate, I think, some of the damage of war. And there are cases where you could have a tribunal that would help resolve disputes, you know, boundary disputes, maritime disputes, that sort of thing, when in the old days perhaps people would have just slugged it out. But on the big picture issues, the fundamental questions that do tend to drive nations to conflict, I'm pretty doubtful that you know, an international court or a UN body is going to resolve those.
There is an international criminal court story in the headlines this morning. I don't know if you've seen it yet, with a Congolese warlord convicted of conscripting children into his army. And that's international law being established and enforced to fight an especially heinous practice of war. Can it make a difference?
It can, but I think one also has to be careful that there are times, I think, where indicting these people makes it, in a way, harder to get them out of power because then they're, you know, scared they'll actually end up in The Hague and in jail. I have no problem with seeing these people in jail and worse, perhaps, in some of their cases, given what they deserve. But it's a practical question, I suppose, of how much the treating these as crimes as opposed to trying to change the regime and letting these guys go, you know, live somewhere in Saudi Arabia if that's what they if they want to give them you know,
safe, refuge.
Refuge. I'm trying to use the word. Yeah, that's a practical question. So I'm not sure how much good or I'm just not sure about that.
But let me dig a little deeper on the credit that I think you gave a minute ago to international law and institutions for the ability to regulate war. I guess you have in mind things like the Geneva Conventions. Can be effective to reduce the amount of killing or killing of civilians or particular atrocities?
Yeah, sure. And those go way, way back, way before the UN. And those are what civilized countries should do. Now, dealing with less civilized countries, you obviously have problems. I don't think the Syrian regime right now is following anything that resembles, you know, Geneva Conventions or any other rules laws of war. And again, when you get in that situation, I think that, unfortunately, it's force or the threat of force is what's needed, which isn't to say that it's not a good idea to try to get the Red Cross to go into various cities in Syria and minimize the slaughter. But at the end of the day, if the regime wants to slaughter people to stay in power, you know, there's a limit to what the Red Cross can do.
But maybe it delegitimizes those kinds of actions that are outside the bounds of what things like the Geneva Convention established, and then it happens less. Then a regime has to be willing to define itself as an outlaw regime in order to engage in that kind of warfare.
I agree with that. But then if you are willing, if you take that step, I think you need to take the next step and say who enforces the delegitimization or who makes sure there's a consequence to delegitimization. Because otherwise, in a way, you get the worst situation, which is the regime does something, everyone says, oh, that's horrible. That's against all these conventions everyone signed. And then nothing happens. And then you really are in a situation where people have gotten away with it. It's sort of even a worse, you know, a worse outcome, right? I mean, that is sort of the criminal goes free and then flaunts his victory.
Yeah.
So,
but are you saying
you need to really be willing to back up these promises of civilized conduct with policemen who enforce the rules of civilized conduct?
Is there any means of enforcement?
Yeah, military force usually.
Now, some countries like Costa Rica have abolished standing militaries. You can go to Wikipedia and look up countries that have abolished their military, and there's a long list, mostly small countries, obviously. But Costa Rica, for example, did it despite being in a bad neighborhood of Central America, if you will, with lots of regional war at the time. Is that a model that other nations could follow, that even the United States, under some circumstances, could follow?
Well, we had a very small military for much of our history. We didn't, the Indians, the Native Americans didn't think it was small, but obviously from a British-German kind of, you know, point of view, we weren't meddling much in their affairs. And, of course, if you're willing to just keep to yourself, maybe you have to be Switzerland and be ready to defend yourself. Maybe you can afford to be Costa Rica and not even have much of a military. But I would not think it would help the world if the U.S., you know, abolished its military. I mean, I just come back to the moments when the U.S. is most withdrawn from the world and had a military that was not capable of being deployed abroad. We're not moments when the world that ended up benefiting the peace and well-being of a lot of people around the world, I don't think.
And what about Europe as an example? People look at Europe and say, well, we may think they're undermilitarized today, some people in this country, but after World War II, after centuries or maybe millennia of fighting each other in Western Europe, they seem to have abolished war, at least within countries in Western Europe.
Well, I mean, they didn't. It turned out in the 90s, and they had to use their military to intervene to stop killing even in Europe. And I would be, I'm very glad they've seemed to have abolished.
In Eastern Europe, as the communist world collapsed.
Yeah, but I'm very glad they seem to have abolished war between Western European countries that required the use of military force, of course, to defeat a non-democratic, to say the least, regime in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. I would, you know, if all the world could become the EU, I think we could do with much less military spending, but I don't think that's likely.
William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, thank you so much for coming on and speaking with us in our End of War series. I really appreciate
it. Thanks. It was an interesting, provocative questions and discussion.
Thank you very much. And we're going to continue this discussion next with a guest from another perspective, Nancy Soderberg, who was an ambassador to the UN in the Clinton administration and has written a book called The Superpower Myth. Stay tuned.
Well, I'm gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside. Study one more.
Elvis and the Million Dollar Quartet laying down their swords and shields as we continue our series, The End of War, inspired by science journalist John Horgan's book of the same name. We're asking you and a variety of guests if humanity can abolish war as a legitimate institution like it abolished slavery as one. Post your answers to our End of War page at WNYC.org/endofwar. And today we're asking what role international law might play in delegitimizing war. We just spoke with William Crystal from the Weekly Standard. With us next is President Clinton's former ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh. She is also the author of The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuse of American Might. Ambassador Soderbergh, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
First, the basic question we're asking everyone. Do you think human beings can ever stop fighting wars?
Yes, I do. Not in my lifetime, but I think human nature is such that pushed to the brink, they will fight for their survival, and they will also abuse their fellow man. And until we have laws and structures that are respected by all of the nations of the world, you're going to still have war.
Is it about laws and structures?
Yes, it's the counter to, you know, everyone in us has the capacity to commit barbarous acts if pushed hard enough. And you see it all through society. Look at the Balkans in the 1990s, very sophisticated society, well-educated population, and they slaughtered each other. Rwanda, 800,000 slaughtered with machetes in 1994. What's happened in Sudan with Darfur, what may happen again in Sudan over the Nuba Mountains. And our own response in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think everyone agrees that our war in Afghanistan was a just war and had strong international support. When we were attacked, we had the right to defend ourselves and go after our attackers. So it is with us very much. The question is, how can you get at the root causes of those conflicts before they get to the point where people take up weapons, and having early interventions, a system of laws and governance that enable people to feel that their rights can be protected. And we're very far away from that. The UN is an imperfect institution. I strongly support the UN, but it can only do so much. And ultimately, it's up to nations and the citizens of those nations to create a society in which minority rights are respected, women's rights are respected. And until that day comes, we're going to have conflict.
I don't know if you heard William Crystal, who was on just before you, his answer to the basic question of whether human beings could ever stop fighting wars was no. And one of the reasons that he gave was that no matter what kind of international law or international institutions you have, most wars are going to be fostered by those outlaw nations that really don't care what international law says. And he used Syria as one obvious example at the moment.
I did hear that, and I have to say I agree with him. My point is the challenge is to get rid of those kinds of regimes and have democratic societies that are very unlikely to go to war. You can have a direct correlation with lack of democracy and lack of basic rights, lack of education. It's now getting extended to water scarcity and a lot of environmental problems as a root cause of conflict. So we need a much more global effort to promote what I call prosperity at a very local level, so that people's have a feel that their basic needs are being met. And when that's out of whack, you're going to have conflict. So for now, yes. Can we eventually develop the world in a way that those basic needs are met and conflict is rare? Absolutely. But it's going to take some time and some visionary leadership that's frankly lacking right now.
Now we'll open up the phones. You heard William Crystal. You've heard the beginning of what Nancy Soderbergh has to say. Listeners, do you think that international law and bodies like the United Nations can ever help abolish war? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our End of War page at WNYC.org/endofwar. Your book, The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuse of American Might, I don't know how much it would contradict one of the main points that William Crystal was trying to make in the previous segment, and that was that in many cases, the less force the United States uses, the more dangerous a place the world is. And he gave perhaps the obvious example of when the U.S. stood back in the first few years of World War II, that only exacerbated the situation. And so the U.S. using less force is not necessarily the means to a more peaceful world. Does the superpower myth contradict that?
Yes, the superpower myth is essentially an argument that while we are the lone superpower, we cannot solve the world's problems on our own, that they're global problems that need global solution. And that book was written during a time of unilateralism, saying we didn't need the rest of the world to resolve our problems. And even the Bush administration came around towards the end and recognized that we need to work with them. But you have to also look at what's not working in the international community. You cannot give the UN a war to fight. It's not capable of it. That can only be done with a multinational force. Getting into World War II earlier, I think, probably would have helped, although we needed time to ramp up. I think the larger question today isn't so much another world war as how do we contain and protect those at risk from these rogue regimes, and when is it our responsibility to intervene? The war in Iraq remains very controversial. Some feel it was the right thing to do. Others feel it was disastrous for American foreign policy. And I think we'll remain divided on that. Look what's happening in Syria today. No one is viewing it as their responsibility to stop the slaughter there. I don't believe that the United States needs to go in, but I do believe that the Arab states and Turkey, the regional Sunni Muslim states, need to get in and stop the violence, perhaps with support of NATO's air power. But why aren't they intervening? Why is it the U.S. that had to lead in Libya, for instance? I sat through the Rwandan genocide at the White House and the killings in Srebrenica in Bosnia. We were way too slow to intervene there. And so it's painful to watch what's happening in Syria, where no one is stepping up to the plate to stop this slaughter. And so as long as you have a regime that is willing to slaughter its own people, the norm in the international community is shifting from it's not our business, we can't interfere in sovereignty, to it's our responsibility to help those people. Why do the people of Libya get protected and not the people of Homs in Syria? That's wrong.
And I noticed your op-ed on Reuters called "We Are Letting Assad Win," and you really are arguing explicitly for the use of force in Syria. I guess you don't say one way or the other in that piece whether it should be the United States or someone else, but you are for the use of force right now in Syria. You and William Crystal, I guess, agree on that much.
I do actually say at the end of that article, it ran on Reuters last Monday, that it should be the neighboring Arab states, not so much the Saudis because of the Salafist problem. You don't want to sort of support the extremists there, but the Jordanians, the Egyptians, others, perhaps even the Turks, they're not Arab, and so it makes it almost easier there. There's no will whatsoever in those countries to do so, but why not? Why aren't we pushing them to do it? And we might need NATO air power. NATO is the only one that can provide the appropriate air power in that region to do so. Why aren't we? Everyone starts the conversation with, oh, the Arabs would never intervene. Well, why not? I think we should be asking those kinds of questions. I don't think it's appropriate for the United States to be the first port of call on all these crises. Regional powers need to step up to the plate. And what the international community can do is help raise those questions, help try and ask various societies what gives them the right to abuse their own population. And there's a norm that's been developed since sovereignty was invented in 1648 at the end of the 30 Years' War in Europe, to say, okay, sovereignty is not an excuse or a right to slaughter your own people. And war will end once the communities of nation agree that the people have rights that the state must protect, and it's up to the state to make sure that they don't get slaughtered. And until that time, you're going to have a very uneven willingness to intervene. We've got 4 million who've died in the Congo. No one ever even hears about that. It took a kid making a YouTube video of Joseph Kony that went viral and 50 million viewers now. Hopefully that will help him get caught. But that war has been going on for decades. So there's a lack of consciousness on this issue that I hope conversations like these will get people energized and say, enough, it's time to it's time to end this slaughter.
And listeners, we have a form that any of you can fill out. It's a survey, a short survey for you to take as part of our End of War series. Hundreds of people have done it already. So you can go to WNYC.org/endofwar and take our very brief End of War survey. Do you think humans can ever abolish war? And a few other related questions. Go to WNYC.org/endofwar. You can also see videos there of various people you may have heard of answering this question, including Dylan Radigan from MSNBC, Al Jazeera English's Marwan Bishara, Nadia Bakri, the widow of the late New York Times reporter Anthony Shadid, and others who have made videos for us answering the question, is war inevitable in the future of humanity? And you can take the brief survey that we have up there at WNYC.org/endofwar, as we're asking Nancy Soderberg, former Clinton administration ambassador to the United Nations and author of the book, The Superpower Myth. Let's go to a phone call. Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Michael.
Hi. I was wondering if maybe the question is not being framed correctly. Maybe the question really is, can men ever get rid of war? Because I'm not a historian, but it seems to me that men are the ones who usually start wars, who fight in them. I'm not saying women never take part, but it seems to me primarily a male bastion. And I was wondering if she had any thoughts about that. I mean, it seems to be a male gender issue.
Michael, thank you. And it's a great question for Nancy Soderberg as a woman in foreign affairs and diplomacy.
It's a very good question and one that is very much being debated around the world. Women actually need to have a seat at the table. I think there's a general accepted view that the solutions would be stronger and war would be more prevented if women had a seat of power. There's a UN resolution 1325 that called in the year 2000 for women to really be part of the solution. And they have to be. I actually believe women at some point would go to war if pushed hard enough. But I think they're the ones who bear the cost and the brunt of war. What happens is the women stay home, try and feed the kids. The children are the ones who don't get food. And women have to deal with the consequences of the violence, the rape, the dislocation while the men are fighting. And so they very much understand the cost of war. And if you look at conflicts around the world, Northern Ireland has been cited for the women's movement that really pushed the peace process on the ground. Hillary Clinton talks about this quite often, as does Bill Clinton. And they're a crucial part of that issue. And women are still not a strong enough voice at the table. So I don't think you'd see women never going to war, but I think they'd be much more cautious about it and try and resolve the underlying conflicts before resorting to the use of force.
Nick in Cliffside Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Brian. I'd like to associate myself with what Nancy Soderberg is saying in terms of real politic and the short run. It's right on. However, I think if you want to address the question in a more deep and fundamental way, we've got to talk about human nature. Your previous guest implied human nature was some kind of immutable thing, and even Nancy Soderberg sort of broad-brushed Yugoslavia as a country that was civilized, and yet they started slaughtering each other. Not everybody in Yugoslavia engaged in the slaughter. Not everybody in Rwanda did. Some people said no. Maybe they were a minority, but some people said no, they would not do these things. The challenge, as I see it, is to transform each one of us, ourselves, into that person who will say no. War is like a cancer that erupts, but it took 30, 40 years to develop. The roots of war are in individual behavior and the violence that we perpetrate on each other and even on ourselves with self-hatred. And, you know, it comes down to personal transformation. And, I mean, it may sound esoteric, but I'm speaking very practically here. Each one of us has the ability to find ways to make our own individual lives more loving, more peaceful, more intelligent, more sane. When we do that, not easy, but when we do that, the cumulative effect of that is that we build up nations and communities and bodies of law and global interaction that will eliminate war organically and naturally.
Nick, though, do you think that's
200 years? But it can be done, and it will be done if we're going to survive as a species. War and long-term survival of humanity are not compatible. This is not sustainable.
It is what you articulate, though, maybe a middle-class, educated, self-help kind of conceit that would be very hard to spread to, you know, countries where there's massive poverty, where people aren't very educated, and get that meme going in a way that would really outlaw war in a global sense?
I totally disagree with that, with the thrust of your question. Again, you take Rwanda as an example. Third world country, massive poverty. Not everybody in Rwanda succumbed to the hysteria. Not everybody in Bosnia did. So I don't think it's a matter of class in terms of money. I think it's a matter of class in terms of level of consciousness. And to some extent, you have a point in that living, you know, in a Western middle class way gives you the luxury of the freedom of not being starving, so you can think about higher things. But throughout the world, I mean, you look at Buddhism, you know, in poor countries where they don't have anything, people are Buddhists and they're peaceful. Look at Tibet.
And, Nick, I'm going to leave it there for time. Thank you very much. Nancy Soderbergh, do you think that lack of resources is a prime, that is competition for scarce resources, is still a prime driver of war? The John Horgan book actually argues that it isn't.
Well, first, let me just address something Nick said. I mean, sure. He himself said that it would take 200 years to get to that point. And I think, yes, we can develop ourselves out of the need for war, but that's going to take some time. So as long as there is inequities, minorities feeling abused, scarcity of water, scarcity of resources, you are going to have conflict. Ultimately, people will fight for those things if pushed hard enough. I'm always stunned at the capacity for barbarity just below the surface of human natures. And I'm also amazed at the better angels that shine through some of the most horrific instances. So you have both right in human nature. And I think without a system that supports the better angels and pushes back the capacity for barbarity, we are going to always have conflict. I think we will eventually get there, but as Nick said, probably 200 years. To your question on resources, I would argue that resources exacerbate conflict problems. There are lots of places in Asia today where you have water resource. Water is the next source of conflict coming. It's being exacerbated by the rise in climate change. You've got a spike in food prices that are going to increasingly spark food riots. So lack of resources absolutely is a source of conflict, but is not always a sufficient cause for conflict. You have to have some other lack of structures and ability to offset those resource shortages before you actually get to a war.
Well, there you have it, folks. Two more views in our End of War series from William Crystal, who was on earlier, and Nancy Soderbergh, author of The Superpower Myth from a few years ago, The Use and Misuse of American Might, an ambassador to the United Nations in the Clinton administration. These days she does various things, including president of the Connect U.S. Fund and the American Task Force on Argentina, co-chair. Thank you so much, Nancy, for participating in our End of War series.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And again, listeners, take our End of War survey. Go to wnyc.org/endofwar.